It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of body, mind, psyche, and spirit, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
During the past 20 years, America has seen a steady stream of gurus, swamis, self-styled masters of many stripes and persuasions, most offering some form of liberation or enlightenment. Much has been written about the guru-disciple or teacher-student dynamic. In a nation which lionizes individuality, there has been great gnashing of teeth over the idea of becoming a pawn of some saffron-robed pundit. And yet we are fascinated by the notion that someone else has the answer we're looking for, will go to extraordinary lengths to get it. What happens when someone comes along and says, there is no answer? There is no path to follow. Indeed, any path is an illusion. Recently, we were made aware of our guest, U.G. Krishnamurti, no relation to the famed J. Krishnamurti, who suggests that the paths themselves are an obstacle. He is an unusual man who appears to be living his words. He travels the world, but claims no disciples. He says he is not a teacher and is not out to liberate anybody. When asked to sum up his own teachings, he replied curtly, "The phrase would be, I cannot help you." There are at least two books of his words, Mind is a Myth and The Mystique of Enlightenment, but he claims no authorship. His words have been quoted in other books, but not because of his efforts. Since this program is dedicated to seeing the world with different eyes, unaltered by the usual conditioning, we invited UG to be a guest. I don't know what we'll talk about with someone who claims to have no answers or advice to impart, but join me for the next hour and find out as I speak with the provocative and enigmatic UG Krishnamurti. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. UG, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed for welcoming me and having me on your program. And you have said very kind words. Probably at the end of this program, many of the phone-besotted individuals will ring you up and take you task, take you for, and question you, your wisdom in putting me on this program. But anyway, we leave it to the listeners. The subject of this program, as I understand, is new dimensions. And that gives me a wide scope of going in one direction or in many directions. Let's see what will come out of this conversation.
I'd like to go back to that time. I think it was in 1967, just after your 49th birthday, when in Sanand you went to hear J. Krishnamurti speak, and an experience occurred. Could you describe that?
Yes, I don't want to go into that in great detail, but what I have been emphasizing lately is that whatever has happened to me has happened despite everything I did. And whatever I did and whatever events people believe that led me into this are totally irrelevant. because it is very difficult for me to fix a point now and tell myself that this is me and look back and try to find out the cause of whatever has happened to me. Because this is not in the field or the area of cause and effect relationship. That is why I am emphasizing, overemphasizing all the time whenever I have a chance to meet people and talk about it and say that it is a causal. Because that's very difficult for the people to understand.
That what happened to you is a causal.
A causal.
It didn't come from your background or experience or life path is what you're
that's
claiming.
That's what I'm saying. It is something like, to use my favorite phrase, a lightning hitting you, jolt of a lightning hitting you, and you don't know what you are left with. See, then if you try to find out for yourself and by yourself, what is it that has happened to me? I have no way of finding out. Has anything happened to me at all? But one thing I can say with certainty is that the very thing that I searched all my life was shattered to pieces, and I said to myself, the self-realization, God-realization, transformation, radical or otherwise, or even enlightenment, there is nothing there to be realized, nothing there to be found there. The very demand to be free from anything, even from the physical needs of the body, just disappeared, and I was left with nothing. And whatever comes out of me depends upon what you draw out of me. So I have actually and factually nothing to communicate, because there is no communication possible on any level. See, the only instrument we have is the intellect. And we know in a way that this instrument has not helped us to understand anything. So when once it dawns on you that that is not the instrument, and there is no instrument, no other instrument to understand anything, so you are left with this puzzling situation that there is nothing to understand. So it would be highly presumptuous on my part to sit on a platform or accept invitations like this and try to tell people and your listeners that I have something to say, that I have come into something extraordinary which nobody has come into. But what I am left with is something extraordinary. Extraordinary in the sense that how it has been possible for me, not through any effort, not through any volition of mine, that everything that every man thought, felt, and experienced before you is thrown out of my system. So you can say that, you see, it is indeed a courageous thing that has happened to me. But I cannot tell people that through courage you can put yourself into that kind of a situation. So it is very difficult to tell people how it happened, because they are only interested in finding out how it happened to me, and their only interest is to find out the cause and what led me into this. But when I tell that this is a causal, it is very difficult for them to understand and accept it. Their interest is to find out a cause and make it happen to them.
Well, I think it is useful sometimes to talk about one's realization as to when and how it happened. And going back to Sonnet in 67, what happened to you is you realized that the speaker, in this case, it was Jay Krishnamurti, was saying something that you were already living, and you realized that in that moment.
You see, the one thing that occurred to me when I was listening to him, suddenly it dawned on me, why the hell have you been listening to this man? From the description, you feel that you are in the same state as that man. So I said to myself, I am in the same state as that man, assuming for a moment that he was in the state that he was describing, and in the same state that the great spiritual teachers were. What the hell have I been doing all my life? Why the hell am I here sitting and listening to him? And then I walked out. With this one single thought in me, whirling as it were, like a whirlpool, how do you know that you are in the same state? See, that means the descriptions of their states that I was very familiar with, and I tried to simulate them in me and tried to experience them, is still there. So this question went on and on and on and on. Suddenly the question disappeared. And I said to myself, there is no reason for me to feel grateful to anybody, to express any thankfulness to anybody. And whatever has happened to me has happened despite listening to this teacher or that teacher or doing this, that or the other. This is something which is not very interesting to the people. They want to know. And I tell them, I myself do not know, and I cannot look at myself and tell myself that I am an enlightened man, that I am a free man, that tremendous changes have taken place in me. So I use this phrase which we very often listen on the commercials. It is not something like that before and after wash, but no washing has, helped me to do anything. It just happened. It's just a happening. I still have to use the word happening because there is no way I can communicate this and give a feel of this to anybody else.
I'm kind of reminded of what it must be like for us when we're infants just coming into the world, and we open our wide eyes and we have no memory or thoughts to think, but we're just seeing the world for the first time and just figuring out how it works and just experiencing it. Would that be similar to what you're talking about?
No, it is not correct to say that because we have no way of going through that all over again. Experience, if there was any kind of an experience in the newborn children, but anything we simulate and try to experience that kind of a thing, it is only from where we stand today. And where we stand today is the product of experiences of all kinds. So anything we experience, although we call it rebirthing or trying to experience how it was like when you were a newborn baby or an infant, is naturally colored by where we stand today. Anything we experience has no relevance, no meaning to what I am trying to say. See, there are many people who talk of rebirthing. You see, it has become fashionable for people to indulge in that kind of a fantasy. And, in Japan, they have some techniques by manipulating certain nerves, you see, at the base of your head. They will make you go through the experience of your own birth. I have always maintained that the experiencing structure at the time of our birth was totally absent. And I always questioned the psychologist, especially Freud, when he made a statement that the birth is a neurotic, that is a traumatic experience. I don't think it is a traumatic experience at all, because there was no experiencing structure there at all. Actually, when the experiencing structure in babies come into operation is very difficult to say. And I'm one of those who believe that the influence of environment is very limited on us. And I maintain, I'm not an authority to assert such things, but it is genetic in its origin and in its expression. You see, everything is genetically controlled. And if we really want to change individuals, the only way we can do it is not to change the environment, not through the cultural infant, by trying to understand what really is the part that the genes play in us, and maybe through some genetic engineering, we can create perfect human beings.
But so you would support genetic engineering?
No, I'm not. I'm at the same time conscious of the fact that it is a very dangerous thing that we are indulging in. When once we perfect, you see, the engineering techniques, we hand it over to the state. And it will be a lot easier for the state to manipulate the individuals and turn them into just, you see, a robots. I'm not against robots. We actually are robots, whether we like it or not. And make them things make them do things which they are unwilling to do, because it takes a lot of time, a lot of brainwashing to teach something to the people, to make people believe in God, for example, to make people believe in a particular political ideology. But to free them from that kind of a thing, we have to brainwash them all over again. It's a very elaborate, long process. And so this is a lot easier for us to use these techniques and change individuals faster than it is possible otherwise. I'm all the time talking, you see.
I'm speaking with U.G. Krishnamurti. We'll be right back and continue our conversation. Eugene, I'm not trying to compare you to any other teachers, but I am struck by something that always intrigued me about Jay Krishnamurti, and that is that he claimed to have no memory, that he had somehow repressed it or lost it in his process. Is that something that has happened with you? Do you have a memory?
No, I don't want to say anything about Krishnamurti. I don't have any idea of what happened to him, and
yeah.
I don't know what he meant when he said this. Actually, your memory becomes very, very, very extraordinary. That is the problem which we have to face today. We have been using memory a lot. I always maintain, you may question this, the experts in the field of brain physiology may question that, but one of these days, they will have to accept what I am trying to say. The brain plays a very, very, very minor role in the functioning of the body. It is not, you see, a creator at all. It is just a reactor. And what this memory is, we really don't know yet. One of these days, these experts who are dealing with this problem of memory will come out with the answers which we have to get what these neurons are. You see, I maintain that the memory is not located in any particular area of the body. Every cell in our body is involved. And my feeling is that we have come or arrived at a point in the history of mankind, that we are going to be confronted with this problem of people who have lost their memories. We have put this memory and the brain to such use for which it is not intended, you see. And so that's one of the reasons why we find that the Alzheimer's disease, or whatever you want to call it, is on the increase. The other day I heard that
Alzheimer's disease.
Uh-huh. 1 in 2 of those in this 80-year bracket are affected by this. And you know that very recently there was a report of the same disease in England. 600,000 people are affected by this problem.
You mentioned misusing our brain.
Misusing memory.
Memory.
Using memory for purposes for which it is not intended. What are you? You are a memory. You see, so we have to use memory in order to survive in the world created by our society or culture or whatever you want to call it. There is no other way. And I know that you will say that it is the extension of the same survival mechanism. No doubt it is.
Well, I remember that fire burns, so I try not to put
automatically
my hand in fire.
There you don't have to use your memory, you see. You know, automatically, you see, remove it. That is the way this human body is functioning. But to survive in this world which we have created, the world of our culture, society, or whatever you want to call it, The constant use of that is an essential thing for us. Otherwise, you have no way. The whole education is built on the foundation of how to develop your memory. I don't know if I'm going off the tangent, but anyway, your new dimensions gives scope for moving in one direction or in all directions.
Yes.
I usually...
Omnidirectional.
Hop, jump, and skip. But we try to stick to this point which I'm trying to make. Unfortunately, the humanity has placed before itself the model of a perfect man. The perfect man is born out of the value system that we have created. And that value system is born out of the behavior patterns of our great teachers of mankind.
So let's say someone like Jesus might be an example of creating
Jesus,
a perfect
Buddha,
man.
And all
Buddha,
the great
yes,
teachers.
Huh? Mohammed,
so you
forth.
See, every human body is unique. Nature is not interested in creating a perfect being, but its interest is to create perfect species.
This leads me to a question, Yuji, and that is that if every one of us is unique, that implies that our, quote, enlightenment, if there is such a thing as enlightenment, would also be unique, so that each of us reaches that state individually and uniquely.
Exactly. That is what I'm trying to emphasize. It is just not possible for us to produce enlightened people on an assembly line. You know, if you look at history, even in a country like India, which prides itself as a land of spirituality, has produced very few enlightened people. You can count them on fingers. But unfortunately, in the marketplace, we have many claimants who say that they are enlightened, out to enlighten everybody. There is a market for that kind of a thing. You see, the demand and supply is responsible for that kind of a thing. But actually, an enlightened man, or a free man, if there is one, he is not interested in freeing or enlightening anybody, because he has no way of knowing that he is a free man, that he is an enlightened man. So it is not something that can be shared with somebody, because it is not in the area of experience at all. So when you say new dimensions, it is very strange to use those words for me. Because there is no such thing as a new experience at all. Supposing you go to a new place, what goes on in your mind, if I may use that word, is that you are always trying to fit whatever you are seeing in the framework of the past, you see. So the moment you say that something is new, it is the old that is telling the new, that is new, you know. So it is very difficult for us to experience anything new, because if there is something new, it is not the particular frame we call the old is destroyed, but the totality of the past is destroyed in one great big blow.
So you're suggesting that what we do is we bring our memory, we bring our past experience, so consequently we can't really experience
anything new,
freshness or the newness.
Yeah. You may not agree with me, and your listeners may brush this aside as absurd and nonsense, but there is no such thing as a new experience, and there is nothing new at all. It's the old that tells that it is new, and through this gimmick it is making that part of what it calls new, part of the old, and maintains its continuity. So whatever you cannot experience does not exist. It may sound as a very dogmatic assertion on my part, but when you try to experience something that you have not experienced before, the whole movement of experiencing structure comes to an end.
Having read some accounts of your previous life, I go back to that experience when you went to see Ramana Maharshi and you asked him, whatever it is you have, can you give it to me? Mm-hmm. And he said, I can give it to you, but can you take it?
You see, unfortunately, that is the traditional answer that is dished out by all spiritual teachers. And I used very strong words, and it is not proper for me to use what I felt at the time. But what is reported in the so-called story of my life is a garbled version of what actually I felt at that time. Uh-huh. Anyway, anything I say today is irrelevant because I don't know what I felt at that particular moment, and there is no way I can relive through that experience from here. So I said to myself, what is it that he has? And if there is anybody, you see, in this world who can receive it is me, I said to myself. And so I walked out, you see. And so that, in a way, decided another phase of my life. The whole traditional approach to the whole question of enlightenment was thrown out of my system. Although I continued to read books on religion, studied philosophy, studied psychology, and studied science, I tried to find out answers, you see, from those people who have not been contaminated by the traditional teachings of the people. Like, I got interested in the Western philosophy, interested in science, and trying to find out the answer to my basic question. My basic question was one question. Although I studied psychology and different schools of psychology, I felt very strongly, where is this mind that we are concerned about, that we are trying to understand, study, change? Why we talk of a total change, you see, in the makeup of the mind? I don't see any such thing as mind there at all, let alone the transformation of mind or mutation of mind. This always intrigued me, and I questioned everybody about this mind. But at that time, I didn't have the certainty that I have today. You see, the certainty that I have, there is no mind, is something which cannot be transmitted to anybody, however hard I may try. Because the very thing which you are using is in jeopardy, and you are not ready to accept that kind of a thing. I try to get answers from every area of human thought, but nothing helped me to find out that question.
Oh, the Buddhists talk about no mind. Is that...
You see, they made a tremendous structure of philosophical thought out of that. They talked of void. They talked of emptiness. You know, the whole Buddhist philosophy is built on the foundation of that no mind. But yet we have created tremendous techniques of freeing yourself from mind. See, all the Zen techniques of meditation try to free you from the mind. You see, the very thing that we are trying to free ourselves from, the very instrument which we are using to free ourselves from the thing called mind, is the mind. And that there is no other thing called the mind other than what you are doing to free yourself from the mind.
I'm speaking with U.G. Krishnamurti, philosopher without portfolio, and we're going to continue our conversation and our exploration of U.G.'s very provocative and intriguing ideas and thoughts. We'll be back in 1 minute.
You're listening to New Dimensions. Another way you can listen is through audio cassette tapes. New Dimensions host Michael Toms has interviewed many of the leading thinkers and social innovators of our time, and these thought-provoking programs are available on cassette. For a free description of some of the most popular interviews on cassette, write New Dimensions Radio, Department K, Post Office Box 410510, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's New Dimensions Radio, Department K, Post Office Box 410510, San Francisco, California, 94141. And now, back to our program.
U.G., you mentioned that you could not bring back the experience of what happened when you were with Ramana Maharshi. And brain science, we were talking about, you were talking about brain, brain science earlier, tells us that the brain records every experience that we have in our life. It's all there somewhere in the record, in the brain. How would you relate that?
You see, what I'm trying to put across to those who are interested in listening, what I have to say, is that there is no such thing as the totality of experiences. And the memory is in frames. So in order to explain what I mean when I say that it is all in frames, and the whole human body is functioning from moment to moment, it is necessary for us to understand one basic thing, that how the senses are operating. You see, what is there is only a response to the stimulus. And it is not translated by anything there except that it is registering the stimuli as the way it is registered through transferring images from one country to the other. You see, dots and cones, or I don't know, whatever you want to call it. There is no linking up of all these things. Each one is an independent frame. Lot of imagination is involved in our trying to understand what actually is happening there. I give you the example of what a friend wanted me to do. I was in a hill resort in India. He said when he reached the top of that mountain, he could have a 360-degree view of the whole place. So he dragged me unwillingly, hesitantly. I pushed myself to the top of that hill and tried to experience what he called a 300-degree view of the whole place. I said to myself, that fellow is kidding himself and imagining things. How is it possible to experience a 300-degree view of this place? What I could see is only 180 degrees. So what he thinks he is experiencing is born out of his own imagination. This is a singularly incapable of creating images, translating these sensory perceptions into an image is the cultural input there. So when the eyes are not looking at you, there is no way that this organism can recreate the image of how you look like. The problem is the creation of images, which is born out of our imagination and mostly out of what is put in there by culture. I don't know what you call this, a conversation. Your listeners will be amused. This is a sort of a monologue.
We're listening. I'm listening. And so our listeners are listening.
So what I'm trying to say is that what the brain does is to translate these sensory perceptions within the framework of memory. That memory is not a constant factor, you see. So when once, you see, say for example, you were seeing without a seer in the sense that there is nobody who is seeing, there is nobody who is looking at things. So what happens is when the light falls on the object and activates your optic nerves, it throws an image on the retina. This is what we have learned from the study of our biology, and that is what the physiologists have taught us in our school. But actually, if you want to experience the fact that that is the image of what you are looking at, is something which cannot be experienced by us. Why I give this example is to free ourselves from many of the ideas we have of what memory is, what is happening. So when once, you see, the optic nerves are activated, they in their turn activate the neurons in the brain and bring the memory into operation and tells that that is that, you see. So the next frame is quite different from what the frame was before. So let me give you the example of the movie camera. The movie camera captures whatever is happening in frames. You take, for example, the movement of hand from here to there. It has 10 different frames to show that the hand has moved from here to there. And in order to see the movement on the screen, you have to use an artificial thing called the projector. And then only you see the movement of hand artificially created by the projector, through the help of the projector. The sound is something like, you see, what they do in the film industry. The sound is 19 and a half frames. There is a difference between what you take and then the sound, 19 and a half frames difference there is. So in exactly the same way, the thought is very slow. By the time it comes and captures this, whatever is there, within the framework, the eyes have moved somewhere else and it is completely wiped out.
I'm thinking of television might be a good example, too, of that, where the picture is never really there. It's just a collection of dots.
It's a collection of dots.
And it requires our brain to put the picture together.
The brain is operating in exactly the same way. The whole thing is registered as dots, and the pictures are taken in frames. So there is an illusion that there is somebody who is looking at the things. Actually, there is nobody who is looking at the things. It may sound very strange to you when I say that there is nobody who is talking. You know, you are the one that is making me talk, and there is nobody here who is talking there. There is nobody. It may sound very strange to you, but that's the way it is. It's so mechanical that we are not ready to accept the mechanical functioning of this living organism.
So you have no sense of identity, personal identity, yourself?
No way, because there is no point there, there is no center there, there is no psyche there, there is no I there. You see, the only I that I can find is their first person singular pronoun. I have to use that first person singular pronoun to differentiate the second person singular pronoun. That's all. But there is nothing there. There is nothing you can say that this is me. That is the reason why I cannot tell myself that I'm a free man, that I'm an enlightened man, and I have no way of knowing that you are not an enlightened man, that you are not a free man, and there is no need for me to free you or enlighten you, because I must have an image of myself, and in relationship with that, I have an image of you. So the images we have there are related to what we would like to be, what we ought to be, what you should be, what we must be.
As you travel around the world, Eugene, and you visit India and Switzerland, and you come to the United States on occasion, there are people that gather around you. What do you think these people are looking for, and why do they gather around you? Why do they come to see you?
They still think that I can help them. I'll give you some conversation that took place recently in Bangalore. And they're all my friends. I don't have any devotees. I don't have any disciples. I don't have any followers. I tell them that they are my followers because they are repeating whatever I am saying. They are memorizing my statements and repeating them. And there is no use kidding themselves that they are not following me. The moment they repeat something which is not theirs, they have become the followers of somebody. So when I asserted with great vehemence that whatever happened to me has happened despite everything, despite my visit to Ramana Maharshi, despite my contacts with J. Krishnamurti and my personal conversations with him, despite all the things that were expected of somebody who wanted to be an enlightened man, I did. One friend in the audience said, "We cannot accept what you are saying, despite, regardless of what I did." And you assert that, you see, even the persons who have been part of your life for years and years, they are irrelevant. How can we accept that? You see, the problem is very simple, he said. If we accept what you are saying, that whatever has happened to you has happened regardless of what you did, and everything is irrelevant, we lose the only hope that we have in you. We still feel that although we have lost faith in them all, we cannot lose faith in you. And I tell them, that's the one that is standing there in you, which makes it impossible for you to free yourself from whatever you are trying to free yourself from, because you have replaced one with another. That is all that we can do. One illusion is replaced by another illusion, and one teacher is replaced by another teacher, because there is no way you can function without replacing one thing with another.
Well, I can recall, J. Krishnamurti, when he was alive, used to talk many times about how it didn't matter about his past experience. There was no teacher, there was no path. And yet, anyone who has presented themselves to the world with any kind of enlightened view, say a J. Krishnamurti, others have, they've still lived a life path that has gotten them to where they are. And there is a path. You've led a life path that got you to where you are.
So, but I cannot, suggest anything that didn't play any part in my life. That would be something false, falsifying the thing, you see.
What you're saying, that each of us has an individual and unique life path, and out of that comes what comes.
The uniqueness of every individual cannot express itself because of the stranglehold of the experiences of others. Mm-hmm. So after all, you don't exist, I don't exist. You and I have been created by the totality of those experiences. And we have to use those experiences in order to function sanely and intelligently in this world.
So are you creating me now?
You are creating me.
Are you creating me?
No, I'm not creating you, because I don't have any image of myself here. So whatever you see here is your own creation, and it is the projection of the knowledge you have of me. No, I don't know if you get what I'm trying. I am not involved with what is going on there in you. But here what is involved is only the reflection of whatever is there in front of me on the retina. And the translation of it is absent because it is part of that movement that is going on there.
So what I get from that is that nothing really matters. That it's just a matter of living each moment as it comes.
We place ourselves in a situation where we think it is possible to live from moment to moment. It is the body that is functioning from moment to moment.
Okay, the body functions from
moment to moment. The one that is interested in living from moment to moment, which is mind, quote and unquote, is not possible because its survival depends upon the repeated experiences, the continuity of the knowledge that it is me. It is not something else, you see. So you have to maintain that center all the time. And the only way you can maintain that center is through the repetitive experiences, repeating the same old experiences all over again. And yet imagine that one day you are going to function from moment to moment. It is this hope that gives you the feeling and also some sort of experiences that you are living from moment to moment. But the possibility of living from moment to moment is never there, because its interest is only to continue. Mm. And this has invented the idea of living from moment to moment, and no mind stuff and all that kind of a thing. And through that gimmick, it knows that it maintains its own continuity.
I have experiences in my life, Yuji, and I can only speak from my experience, where I am so involved in the experience, so immersed in the experience, that I have no sense of myself, that I have no sense of my identity. I think other people have similar experiences. I think we all do, where we're so at one with our activity that we lose ourselves in the activity. And in that sense, we are living in the moment.
It is not correct to say that, because your involvement in whatever you are doing, you see, is a sort of high. You see.
Sort of what?
High? Yes.
It's just an experience.
It's just an experience which you want to place it on a higher level and think that you are absorbed in it, you see. It is like
but
trying
you're
to...
not thinking about it.
The thinking,
thought doesn't enter into it.
No, the thought is very much there because you have made that into an extraordinary experience and you are wanting to be like that always is the one thing that it is not possible.
Walking in the
woods. A musician, you see, thinks that he is absorbed in what he is doing. So, it is demanding your total attention to express whatever you are doing. And when two things are not there, it is a lot easier for you to express it effectively than when you are thinking about it.
But it's the only time that I really think about that experience is after it happens. Then I reflect on it. When I look up in the sky and see a hawk flying across the sky, I see the hawk. And then afterwards I reflect on it and say, oh, I saw a hawk.
That is
but in the moment of seeing the hawk, I'm not thinking about it.
You see, that is not correct because we have been made to believe, and probably you accept that statement, that while you are experiencing a thing, you are not aware of it. The fact that you recall, whether you name that as a hawk or not, implies that, you see, you were very much there. I know a lot of people who tell me that we were in thoughtless state. There were moments when I was not there. But when once you are there, it is finished once and for all. And there is no way you can, you see, link them up together and create a continuity there. So it is highly questionable, that statement, that when you are experiencing a thing, you are not aware of it, and you become aware or conscious of it only after the experience is gone. If that is so, it would have shattered the whole experiencing structure once and for all. It would be like something... An earthquake hitting this place, and what happens, nobody knows. A shifting of things have taken place, and it functions in a very normal, natural way, and it has found a new sort of an equilibrium.
I'm going to continue my conversation with
E.G.
Krishnamurti in just a moment. I want to keep our dialogue going here, so that's my quest. So I have a question. Why are we here?
It's very simple. You have a program, and people want this kind of a thing. And I have become a party to it.
Why are we here as human beings living right now?
Oh, you mean that? Not why we are here.
Well,
carrying
too.
On this dialogue.
That too. There's many levels here.
Why do we ask that question? Are we here? What is it that tells you that you are here? Are you there now? It is the knowledge that tells you that you are here.
There's some,
that I am here.
I have some awareness of being, of experiencing. I have some I can feel.
If the feeling is also a thought, you see, we want to feel that feelings are more important than the thoughts, but there is no way you can experience a feeling without translating that within the framework of the knowledge you have. Say, for example, you tell yourself that you are happy. You don't even know that sensation that is there is happiness. So you capture that sensation within the framework of the knowledge you have of what you call a state of happiness and the other state is unhappiness. So what I'm trying to say is, it is that knowledge that you have that has created this and helps you to experience yourself as an entity there, as something there. I'm not particularly fond of the word awareness, you see. It is misused.
Okay.
It is a rubbed coin.
I accept that.
And everybody uses that, you see, to justify some of his actions. You see, instead of admitting something, that you did something wrong.
Is there a word that you'd use in place of it?
I was not aware of what was going on there.
Is there a word that you'd use in place of it?
So awareness is an integral part of the activity of this human organism. When I say human organism, this activity is not only specifically in the field of human organism, but all forms of life have this. You see, the dog, cat, just looks at you. It is in a state of choiceless awareness there. And to turn that into an instrument which you can use to bring about a change is to falsify that. Awareness is an integral part of the activity of the living organism. And so awareness is not just the right kind of a word to use and tell yourself that I am aware of this. What is going on there is it is impossible for us to separate ourselves from the rest of the things that are happening here. So you are not different from the chair you are sitting on. And what separates you from the chair is the knowledge you have of that this is a chair, that you are sitting on the chair.
Yeah, I accept
that. But the fact that the sensation that is involved in this relationship, you and the chair, is the sense of touch, and the sense of touch does not tell you that you are separate from this chair in which you are sitting. So actually what makes you feel is the gravitational pull of the body, the heaviness of the body, the existence of the body you feel is because of the gravitational pull. You said somewhere at the very beginning that you are affecting everything there and everything that is there affecting you. The fact of this statement is something which cannot be experienced by you because it is one unitary movement. The moment you separate the two and say that this is the response to that, you already brought the knowledge you have of the things into operation and tell that this is the response to that stimulus.
Well, the physicists tell us that it's all interconnected, the quantum physicists.
Yes.
Tell us it's all interconnected, that we're all part of the same stuff.
But they have
the
arrived at that as a concept. So did the metaphysicians in India arrived at the fact that they call it a fact that there is no such thing as a space, you see. Space is very essential for you to survive in this world, you know. But the fact that there is such a thing as a space can never, never be experienced by you. And one scientist came to see me, and he made this statement that there is no such thing as a space, there is no such thing as time, there is no such thing as matter. I said, you are repeating a memorized statement. Probably you will give me an equation to prove that there is no such thing as a space. But supposing it is a fact in your life that there is no space. I always give crude examples. What happens to a relationship you have with your wife? You know, when people throw these phrases at me that there is no observer, the observer is the observed. It's very interesting, you see, to discuss that for theologians and metaphysicians and scientists. But when it percolates to the level of our existence, day-to-day existence, and in our relationship with the people around us, if you tell yourself that the observer is the observed, apply that to a situation where you are about to make love to your wife, what happens to that?
Well, then it would be it would translate into a situation where if one is the observer and the observed, that I'm taking responsibility for everything that's happening in my life.
Yeah, but that's the end of all relationships. That's finished.
But it goes back to
the observer is the observed is a meaningless statement, repeated ad nauseam,
mm-hmm.
and they actually do not know when that is the case how it operates in our lives. All relationships are finished.
So are we just on automatic?
Automatic, repeating words, phrases, memorized. They have no relevance to the way we are functioning.
Are you just on automatic?
I am an automaton. There is not one thought which I can call my own. This computer, you see, has no information on a particular subject. It is silent. So you are operating the computer. It is your interest to find out what is there in this computer. And whatever comes out of me, or whatever you call it, you see, what do you call that printout, is yours and you are reading something in it.
So I'm the dreamer and you're the dream. I'm creating.
You have created me and you have all the answers and you are asking the questions. And I'm telling you that...
I don't think I have all the answers.
Otherwise, how can there be any questions? You are not sure that they are the answers.
Well, I'm kind of every person here, kind of asking questions of that every person might ask.
For which they already have the answers. But they are not sure that they are the answers, and they don't have the guts to brush aside the persons that have given those answers. There the sentiment comes into the picture, and you lose the guts and to throw the answer and the one who has given the answer out of the window.
So what I get from that is that it's real important to honor our own individual
to
sense.
Be yourself, you see, and... To be yourself, you don't have to do a thing. The culture demands that you should be something other than what you are. What a tremendous amount of energy we put to that will, effort. If that energy is released, what is it that we can't do? How simple it would be for every one of us to live in this world. See, you know, it's so simple. It is so simple.
Eugene, so, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
There's a lot more that we can cover, and maybe we'll do it next time. So,
fine, thank you.
I've been speaking with Eugene Krishnamurti, and there are at least two books that contain Eugene's words, if you'd like more, Mind is a Myth and the book called The Mystique of Enlightenment, neither of which Eugene claims the authors or claims copyright ownership of, but they are available. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of the New Dimensions Radio community and all those who are members of Friends of New Dimensions, I'm wishing you well.
New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in San Francisco. New Dimensions is made possible in part by listener contributions and by the members of Friends of New Dimensions. For more information about how you can participate in the New Dimensions Radio Network and to receive a free New Dimensions newsletter, please write New Dimensions Radio, Department K, Post Office Box 410510. San Francisco, California, 94141. If you'd like to receive a cassette copy of this program, send $9.95 plus $1 for postage and handling. California residents add sales tax. Please be sure to specify which program you're ordering. The address again is New Dimensions Radio, Department K, Post Office Box 410510. San Francisco, California, 94141. Executive producer for New Dimensions is Justine Toms. Technical director is Lou Judson.